Well, good afternoon. I am Rich DeMond, and I have the pleasure today of introducing Dr. Meredith Richards, who will speak on Virginia Rail and both passenger and freight. Ms. Richards was the vice mayor of Charlottesville, and she was on the city council for 8 years. She has her PhD in psychology from the University of Illinois and has taught on the faculty of Virginia as well as the University of Louisville. Dr. Richards has served 3 terms as the president of Virginia for High Speed Rail. She's currently the co-chair. She's the president of Virginia Rail Policy Institute and formerly a member of Governor Mark Warner's Commission on Rail Enhancement for the 21st Century and president of the Virginia Transit Association. So she comes with a lot of experience, and I first became aware of her work when she was pushing for the Northeast Regional, which started in 2009 and is a wonderful service from Lynchburg through Charlottesville all the way up to Boston. She served on regional state boards, including the Charlottesville Albemarle MPO, the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, Thomas Jefferson Partnership for Economic Development, Virginia First Cities Coalition, and the Virginia Municipal League. And she started the Charlottesville Rail, a nonprofit to promote enhanced passenger rail for Central Virginia, as well as a consortium for local governments, economic development authorities, and organizations throughout the Virginia 29 corridor that are working to bring more frequent and accessible passenger rail to the region. Without further ado, Dr. Richards.
I brought 2 important things with me today. I brought a train schedule for each of you. All the Virginia services are on that schedule. The only thing that's changed since these were published is a slight alteration in the Norfolk schedule, Norfolk to Washington and on to New York City. That schedule has changed slightly, but everything else is there and should be accurate. Every train you can, Amtrak train you can catch in Virginia and where you can go on it. And the other important thing I brought was this wonderful stool my son made for me that raises me up 3 or 4 inches, and it's got non-skid surfaces, so I'm not in danger of falling. And so thank you for indulging me on that. It's just a little bit more comfortable when I can sort of see all of you instead of you all seeing me right about here up. So I learned that a long time ago. So yes, thank you very much for having me. Thank you for Rich DeMong. And thanks for Madison Cummings, for both of you, for asking me to be here today. And I really appreciate the senior statesman. I've been here a number of times, both as a speaker and as a guest. And I am going to talk a little bit today about rail policy as well as sort of the gee whiz stuff that goes on, what our services are and so forth, because I know that this is a very inquisitive group. I've been here enough times as a speaker to know that you ask very good questions and you're very thoughtful and you're involved in public policy. So with no further ado, I'd like to start. Let me make sure this is working. All right, my title today is Passenger Rail is Alive and Well in the Commonwealth, but is Freight Rail on Life Support? So let me tell you about something that happened on February 18th and 19th of this year. Over 300 people rode the Gulf Coast inspection train from New Orleans, Louisiana to Jacksonville, Florida. This beautifully decked out train had 300 officials and elected officials and federal agency and Amtrak officials on it. And their purpose was to inspect this, see if I can make the laser work. If you follow the red line, inspect this corridor right here that follows the Gulf Coast between New Orleans and Jacksonville, Florida. Now, the reason they were doing that is because there used to be rail service, Amtrak service on that corridor. And when Hurricane Katrina destroyed most of the infrastructure, it has never been restored since 2005. This inspection train took that trip, it was a two-day trip, in order to assess the tracks and the stations and just generally to raise awareness of the possibility that service, Amtrak service on that corridor could be restored. It was sponsored by the Southern Rail Commission, which is a coalition of the five governments, the state governments, that are on that corridor, as well as Amtrak and the federal, some federal officials. So it stopped at 13 stations across four states. And I would like to show you just what happened that day. All right. Okay. There you go. Do I start it, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
With the clicker?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, Jim. Jim is my guru here.
If Amtrak were an airline, it would be the fifth biggest airline in the country. So of course the taxpayers have a role in this.
Come here, they love you. Now we're going to get them here. We're going to get them on board. We're going to get them on this train, and they're going to be here, and they're going to stay, and they're going to love it. And this is going to be where they talk to all of their friends from all across the nation and say, if you want to see the beauty of God's great creation, go to the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Thank you.
The top brass, we've got the local leaders. We're going to make this work for Mississippi and for the taxpayers. Thank you very much.
We just need more people. We just need more people to come and see this beautiful city, come see this beautiful Gulf Coast. Come and stay a week or a month or two. Bring their money with them.
You know, that video still gives me goosebumps. I was not on the train. I wasn't there. But when I saw this, I immediately recognized something that's happening across the country. Literally, it's happening everywhere. And because we did it kind of first here in Central Virginia with Seaville Rail and the Piedmont Rail Coalition and bringing the first state-supported train, the Northeast Regional, to the U.S. 29 corridor, I'm often invited. I've been invited all over the East Coast to talk about how we did it. And the theme is, if we could do it, you can too. But there are groups, advocacy groups, that have formed from Maine to California that are now working to get more Amtrak service to their communities. And that is a remarkable thing. It's literally happening all over the country. But as you'll see, not all the states have the kinds of resources that Virginia has with great foresight created for just that purpose. Let me tell you a little bit about the history. Of course, we all know about Amtrak, the National Railroad Passenger Corporation, which was established in 1971 by Congress. It was a way to keep passenger rail from dying, literally dying, in America. It was President Nixon who said, I will not be president who presides over the death of passenger rail. And he worked with Congress to try to keep it going, although frankly, at that point in time, few people actually expected it to succeed. And indeed, all the railroads turned their equipment and their routes over to Amtrak. When it was formed, there were over 400 trains turned over to Amtrak, and on May 1st, 1971, the day service started with Amtrak, over half of them were taken out of service permanently. So, in fact, this is one of the kinds of trains that were turned over. These were the Metroliners who had already been running in the Northeast Corridor at speeds of up to 150 miles an hour. Did you know that in 1970? So they were the sort of shining stars of the new Amtrak, but most of the equipment was more like this at that point. And in fact, that train was about to be retired. But for a couple of decades at that point, the railroads had been in a state of terrible decline. And of course, in the 1950s, with the onset of the interstate highways, there was almost no future for passenger rail. Everyone deserted the trains and started taking the interstates across the country. So that's why passenger rail absolutely needed to be saved by federal intervention at that point. Now, here's what's happening now, however. Let's see if I can use this laser. All right, starting about 1977, somewhere around in here, you know, the ridership, this is a ridership graph on Amtrak trains across the nation. And right in the 70s, wait, is that right? Yeah. This is the point about this low point here where Charlottesville Station was renovated. We only had 28,000 passengers a year taking trains out of that station at the time. Nobody really expected it to be needed very much. So that was kind of a low point. But as you go into the 2000s, the early 2000s, and for the next 14 or 15 years, you start getting, at this point, double the ridership that it started with. And for the last five straight years, Amtrak has carried more than 30 million passengers a year on its routes. So what are its routes? Amtrak operates 15 long-distance routes. They get about 4.5 million passengers a year and serve 318 cities, 219 of which have no other rail service but one Amtrak train. And I love these. I love the names of some of these. Some of you have probably taken these routes. I love names like the Pacific Surfliner. I love that. The Silver Meteor and the Southwest Chief. They just invoke an earlier era of when rail travel was the only way to get around. It was very romantic and comfortable, and everybody loved it. And I love the way those routes, many of which have been in existence and running for a century or more, I love the way that that they evoke an earlier era. But we also have Northeast Corridor study, including these wonderful Acela trains that are capable of and run in parts of the Northeast Corridor between Washington and Boston at speeds of up to 150 miles an hour. And they're a big money maker for Amtrak service. In the Northeast Corridor, there are 11.7 million passengers who take Amtrak trains. And then there's something new, relatively new, that actually has been a new paradigm for Amtrak and its relationship with the states that it serves. And that is, oops, let me go back, state-supported routes. I'm sorry, I'm doing that wrong. I'm trying to get to the laser, but you can see state-supported routes. And they're really where the ridership is growing. 14.6 million passengers last year on state-supported routes. Now, these, since The federal government required that states take over all their regional routes and fully fund them, both the capital cost and the operating cost. And this started on October 1st, 2013, that states had to start supporting all of their regional trains. So it is a new paradigm, and it's a result of federal legislation that sort of redefined the relationship between Amtrak and the states. So, let's go on. So, we have all this ridership growth taking place, and it's extraordinary. It really is amazing to watch, for example, at the Charlottesville station on a Friday evening, you can watch, or Friday morning, actually. We don't have any evening trains going north, but Friday morning on the Northeast Regional, you'll see 300 people boarding that train. Easily. And on Sunday evening, you'll see those 300 people getting off again. It's not unusual to see those kinds of numbers. And I'm going to give you some more idea of how Charlottesville stands when it comes to its embracing passenger service. But so why isn't, you know, why aren't we getting more routes and more trains all over America? There are constraints. There are significant constraints. If it were up to you and me and the other people who ride trains and some people who depend on them, then we would have more trains running every day. But of course there are constraints. And these are matters of policy. In part, there are matters of policy, and one aspect of public policy is funding. For any kind of transportation mode, there are public policies as to how investments are made and if they're made in the infrastructure, in the capital cost, and in operating costs. So those are significant constraints, which I'll tell you more about in a minute. Another huge constraint in America, across the United States, is the infrastructure, not just the age of it, and many of the tracks, much of the infrastructure, even here in Virginia, dates back, you know, 100 years or more. Some of ours dates back to the Civil War. But the aging condition, of course, that implies, and the capacity of the whole system, but also who owns the tracks, who owns the infrastructure across America. And that's a huge constraint on the growth of passenger rail service. And then, of course, regulations, most of them federal regulations, that can, at times, constrain the growth of passenger rail service. So let's talk first about the public policy of funding. After Amtrak was formed in 1971, it was the first time in history the federal government had actually started investing in rail. Now let me show you. You see all the blue here. That is the federal investment from 1949 to 2012. In the highway system. Now, this is public policy, right? What do we put our money into? That reflects our priorities, and that was the highway system and still is. Next is your airlines, and that's things like the, you know, airports and the TSA and so forth. That's a big federal investment. And then, of course, transit being basically bus services and suburban or urban rail systems. But then inner city rail is that little strip at the bottom. And that reflects the federal investment in inner city passenger rail over this period of time. And in fact, just since 2008, you know, our federal fuel taxes do not pay for transportation. Long since the cost of transportation exceeded what our fuel taxes bring in to the federal government, so they're always bailing out the surface transportation budget with just ordinary income tax money and other things. And so we've put more money just bailing out the highway system since 2008 than we've ever put into Amtrak in all the years it's been in existence. So Here's basically the federal transportation funding policy that just reflects 25 years of funding. And you can see that rail takes only has taken in all those years only 4% of the federal transportation budget. And I sometimes hear from people who say, I don't hear it much anymore, but when we first started advocating for more rail service, and I would go all over the state and talk to groups and all over Central Virginia, I did sometimes hear, well, I don't think we ought to be investing in passenger rail. We shouldn't be, quote, subsidizing it. And I just show them graphs like this and numbers like this and say, look, we quote, subsidize every mode of transportation, and most of them at much higher levels. And any mode of transportation is going to require some federal investment. So we invest in the highways in particular and other modalities a great deal more than we invest in rail. So next time you hear somebody say that, that's what you need to tell them. So, okay. So, yes. So what have been the impacts of these policies? Well, since 1970, the railroads have been cutting back on their infrastructure. And that started long before the 70s. It started long before Amtrak. The railroads started pulling up their own tracks, for example, and retiring them and pulling up the steel as a cost-cutting measure because they weren't thriving in terms of business. And so during that time, they pulled up 107,000 miles of track, which is 2.5 times the entire length of the interstate highway system. And today we have less than half of the tracks that we had in 1970. And yet freight volume in particular, as well as passenger volume, is up by 3 times. And what does this mean? A lot more trains on a lot less infrastructure. So sometimes we run into capacity issues where they're coming into conflict. And you'll hear more about that too. As we go on. So sometimes we get a breath of fresh air when it comes to funding and public policy, and partly because of things like what you watched taking place on the Gulf Coast, partly because people all over the country are reaching out to their elected leaders and saying, we want more rail. We get it, what it does for us. We get what it does for our communities. People in Congress are starting to listen. And in 2015, there was a new surface transportation bill passed. It's called the FAST Act, Fixing America's Surface Transportation, or FAST Act. It's authorized through 2020. And for the first time in history, it actually incorporates inner-city passenger rail as a funding category for the federal government. Now, basically, that means there is not necessarily going to be appropriated all that money, but for the first time, it actually has been authorized that the federal government will spend money in the surface transportation budget on rail. Now, Amtrak right now has to go to Congress for its funding every year with its hands out. Has to go through all these congressional hearings and provide all this data to justify their continued existence, and any growth and any new models that they come up with, they have to justify to Congress. So every year, it's a reauthorization process or a rebudget process for Amtrak. That's why this is so significant. It is a recognition of the tremendous importance of passenger rail to the nation. And there are 3 new grant programs that are related to intercity passenger rail in this bill. Now, they're still debating, both the House and the Senate are still debating how much money to give these programs. So that's still very much up in the air. Virginia is no different, has been very little different, or was for years, in terms of the way it funded rail. In fact, until 2005, this was the Virginia budget The Virginia Transportation Trust Fund, paid for largely by fuel taxes, has a distribution formula. It's right there in the state code. The state has to give 78.7% of that money to highways, has to give 14.7% to transit, then the ports and the airports, and until 2005, there was no money provided for rail in the state budget. And of course, then what does this reflect? These are the impacts of our public policies. So, in this period between 60 years, let's just look at what began to happen. Here's the 1930, we have 4,000 and some odd rail miles in Virginia and 7,000 highway miles. And about 40 years later, the rail miles are starting to shrink. The highway miles have gone up astronomically. And by 1990, the rail miles continue to shrink. And, of course, there are highway miles. So these are this is the way public policy reflects itself. So, all right. Now, we actually have some breaks. That Virginia has been actually a national leader in terms of changing its public policies for funding for intercity passenger rail. And it started with Governor Mark Warner in 2005. As Rich mentioned, I was on his commission for rail enhancement for the 21st century. And we basically said to the governor and to the General Assembly, you need to have a dedicated fund for passenger rail. You've been giving zero money to passenger rail in the state. And if it's going to grow, if passenger rail is going to grow, and people were beginning to see that it was a great alternative for building highways. We were starting to see all the air pollution. We were starting to see the congestion. And people were beginning to understand that the whole idea of building highway is probably not that sustainable. And people were starting to demand more rail service. And so in 2005, Virginia's first dedicated fund for passenger rail was begun. It was called the Rail Enhancement Fund. And it devoted a portion of, ironically, the vehicle rental tax to rail. It came to only $23 million annually, which may sound like a lot, but it was used only for capital investments, no operating cost, for either passenger projects or freight projects. The problem is that it required a 30% match. That means that now the infrastructure is all owned by the corporate railroads, and so all of it meant public money being invested in private infrastructure in partnership, in collaboration. But what Governor Warner insisted upon was that the railroads had to provide a 30% match for any money the public put in. Now, that's just fine if you're a freight railroad and you've applied for money because you want to expand the capacity or you want to correct your signals or you want to install some new switches. That's just fine for your business model. But if it's for passenger rail, those railroads have to provide a 30% match. And that means they have to want to do it. And that means that whatever route you're sending your trains on, your passenger trains, there has to be something they want to get out of the infrastructure investments too. And that's the way it worked. And that's the way it still works. So if they were going to provide who else is going to provide a 30% match? Amtrak can't do it. We were barred from using federal funds for the match. So it had to be but the freight railroads. And that meant it had to be something that also benefited them and their bottom line. And that's perfectly understandable. You'd think the same way if you were a corporate manager of a railroad. So the policy goal when Virginia started investing in passenger rail was almost single-mindedly to reduce congestion on the highways. That was the goal. And also to reduce some emissions as well, and to make to reduce the use of fossil fuels in transportation. So, although of course our trains use fossil fuels too in Virginia, but the policy goal was to basically divert as many people and as many goods from moving on the highway in highway vehicles to the trains. And so that's why the state has always justified, and it's why the federal government essentially justifies investing in rail, passenger or freight rail. So, and then in 2013, we began, because federal legislation had been passed, which I mentioned earlier, which basically put all the responsibility for the short-distance regional trains, many of which Amtrak was already running at their own expense, putting that responsibility onto the states. And so Virginia recognized that they were going to need money to operate passenger rail. So Governor McDonnell very foresightedly pushed through a new legislation called the Intercity Passenger Rail Operating and Capital Fund. And it was part of his 2013 transportation bill. It passed. And now Virginia supports six regional trains with that fund. Four of them had been there before, and they were trains that Amtrak paid for, but two of them are new trains that had never been in Virginia's system before. So Virginia now supports six regional trains. The IPROC, we call it, the Intercity Passenger Rail Operating and Capital Fund, comes to about $50 million a year to invest in intercity passenger rail. So, here's Virginia's state-supported network. As I say, it's totally funded. Every Virginia train supported by the state is part of the Northeast Regional System. Every one of them goes into Washington Union Station and up into the Northeast Corridor, which is between Washington and Boston. They all do that, all six of them. There's only one train that we have right now on this corridor, parallel to the US 29 corridor. It's the Lynchburg Northeast Regional. It started in 2009. And Richmond has two that begin in Richmond and go up into the Northeast Corridor. Two of them originate in Newport News. They were there before the state started funding them. And Norfolk now has rail service that it hasn't had in well over 40 years. And it now is funded by the state. So the two new trains funded by the state are the Norfolk train and the Lynchburg train. The other four were already in existence, but the state had to assume the responsibility for funding them. So all of them go into the Northeast Corridor, which is 457 miles in length. And it turns out that they are collectively the most successful trains in the Amtrak system. So here, just a graph, a map of our Amtrak services, and you can see we don't have connections to Richmond. The green is connecting buses. But did you know that Charlottesville has buses coming in to connect with both the Cardinal and Crescent service every day? They come in to connect with the Crescent. 3 days a week they come in to connect with the Cardinal from Richmond. Also, we get daily buses down from Washington to connect with trains that run out of Charlottesville. So we actually get some days up to six Amtrak throughway buses that come in to connect people with our trains. And so here's our Lynchburg service here, starting in Lynchburg, going up into Alexandria and then across the Potomac to Washington and up to Boston. And then here are the other trains, the red lines are the other trains in the system. It's basically two corridors, the one parallel to I-95 and the one ours parallel to US 29. So these have been incredibly successful. The Lynchburg train, when it began in 2009, was in its first year the most successful train in the Amtrak system in terms of its cost recovery, the revenue it brought in and how it recovered its cost. And in fact, it's been paying for itself ever since then. So for the next 5 years, starting in its first year running in fiscal year 2010. Our Lynchburg train, actually, if you can see these numbers, ranked number one in the Amtrak system for all the short distance and state-supported trains. And last year it dropped down to number two, and the Newport News train took over as number one. But all of our regional trains in Virginia rank one, two, three, sometimes four or five in the national system in terms of how they pay for their cost. It's a remarkable story. Virginia is also contemplating and working on intercity high-speed rail as part of the Southeast High-Speed Rail Network. We have a coordinated effort going on with the state of North Carolina to connect Raleigh, North Carolina, from here up to Petersburg and Richmond and on into Washington and the Northeast Corridor with trains that we nominally call high-speed rail, but more accurately, they're higher-speed rail. You know, they're designed, the whole system's being designed to run at speeds of 110 miles an hour, so it's not like bullet trains are going to come anytime soon. But both the state and the federal government have put a fair amount of money into planning for that system and studying it, as has North Carolina. So the first link between Raleigh and Richmond and to Washington will conceivably be in place sometime during the next, I would say, decade. And the rest of the system goes down to Jacksonville, Florida, and those states have invested absolutely nothing at this point in their part of the system. It's like, you know, you plan an interstate highway and only some states invest in it. And that's what's happening right now. North Carolina and Virginia are doing that. Now, ideally, a high-speed rail system would look like this. This was done by a group, an advocacy group, trying to bring passenger rail to the I-81 corridor. How many of you would really like to get off that highway? Right. Well, a group called Rail Solution has been organized for at least a decade now. They've been advocating for passenger rail on the I-81 corridor to no avail for quite some time. Why to no avail? Because Norfolk Southern owns the tracks and they do not want passenger trains on that line. Norfolk Southern owns the tracks that our trains run to Washington on also, but they have been allowing, shall we say, agreeing to having passenger trains on their lines. But they will not agree to trains on what is called their Shenandoah line, which parallels I-81. But Rail Solution made up this wonderful conceptual drawing of what the Shenandoah Valley might look like with a whole interstate high-speed rail system. In fact, they call it the steel interstate. And it would be basically freight trains and passenger trains both running on an electric grid at high speeds, very high speeds, totally separated from each other on dedicated tracks instead of commingled on shared tracks as they are today. And they would be physically separated by some distance, and then they would be it would just be wonderful. I mean, what else can I say? But that is all conceptual at this point. So, with the combination of the two funds that I've mentioned to you that Virginia has been insightful enough and foresighted enough to start, we've invested now over $438 million in passenger rail projects since 2006, just after the Rail Enhancement Fund began. And these are numbers that Virginians for High-Speed Rail has provided for me. It's resulted in the state of Virginia in a 20% increase in passenger rail service. Okay, so, and then 76% of Virginians have new, improved, or increased passenger rail service, that is within a 30-mile radius of where they live. They have access to service now as a result. And there's been a 77% increase in ridership since that time. And 78 million more potential vehicle miles traveled, removed from our roadways. So that's a pretty impressive result, actually, from that kind of investment. So what are some other constraints? I mentioned infrastructure constraints. Well, here's an example. This is the Long Bridge across the Potomac. This is where all the trains that come through Virginia, that originate anywhere in the south or southeast. It's where all the Virginia Railway Express, the commuter rail system that operates up in northern Virginia, all of them come across. And all of the freight trains that go up into the Northeast Corridor. Any rail that goes into the Northeast Corridor has to cross that two-track bridge across the Potomac. That bridge is 100 years old. It's rusting. It's in terrible condition. It needs replacing, and it creates a huge bottleneck. CSX owns that bridge. They own the tracks. So when we get up to Alexandria on Norfolk Southern tracks, then CSX owns the rest of the infrastructure across the Potomac to Washington Union Station, and they are not happy when new passenger rail service wants, when Virginia wants to start new services. One of the things that Virginia has to do is sign agreements with CSX for a little bit of track time, just a little space of time every day on that bridge when their trains can get across. And it is a terrible bottleneck. And they, of course, lease the time, too. They lease that time. And so that is one of our big bottlenecks. That's just one of them. Here's another one. This one is up in New York. How do you get to Penn Station? Through the Hudson River Tunnel. Okay, that's an old postcard. I mean, this tunnel is over 100 years old. It's two lanes, you know, and so one lane in to Penn Station and one lane out to Penn Station, 24 trains every hour pass on each track, okay? So anytime you take the train to New York City, and you've started out in Washington and you're in the Northeast Corridor, that's what you go through. Now, unfortunately, when Hurricane Sandy came through, it flooded that tunnel. And what's happening now is that all the salt and chemicals left behind are destroying all the systems within the tunnel. It is in danger of failing, all the systems, the electric systems, the lighting systems. These things are necessary to operate trains in them. If it fails, well, everything going into or out of New York Penn Station is going to come to a grinding halt. And we can't let that happen. It needs repair. But how do you repair something without shutting it down? The answer is you build a second parallel tunnel under the Hudson River, which is going to be $13 billion project. And fortunately, Amtrak is in the planning stages and moving well along, even beginning to contract some of the services to do just that, to build a new tunnel under the Hudson River. That tunnel will be used as an alternative route while this tunnel, which will take about 5 years, is being fixed. Once they're both in service, wow, you'll get a lot better access to New York City, Penn Station. And so, but these are the kinds of things that get in the way. So that growth curve that I showed you at the beginning of people taking passenger trains, when these kinds of bottlenecks get out of the way, your trains will get there faster, the run times will be shorter, they'll be more reliable, and you'll have better service and more frequent service. So all tracks in Virginia, all of the tracks that our passenger trains run on are owned by corporate investor-owned railroads, okay? And I love this picture, which was taken by a friend of mine in Ashland, Virginia, who happened to catch this moment in time where the freight train is going south and the Amtrak train is going north. And they do share the tracks. So when that Amtrak comes back south, it's going to use the track that the freight train's on now. And that's the way it operates, which creates, as you can imagine, logistical problems, because they're usually 20 to 25, or have been historically, freight trains for every passenger train that runs. And so it's not an unusual circumstance for those, for the dispatching of those trains to use those tracks to get to come into conflict. Who owns the tracks in Virginia? Norfolk Southern or CSX? All of them. 3,400 miles of track. 2,000 of it owned by Norfolk Southern, 1,000 by CSX, and I don't know who operates the other 400, but it's a railroad that owns it. We also have, I think, seven short line railroads, some of which may own infrastructure. Only in the country, about 700 miles of the tracks in the Northeast Corridor are actually publicly owned. A few states have invested in short corridors that were abandoned. Largely, they were abandoned already by the freight railroads, and they are now running passenger trains on public-owned infrastructure, but only for short corridors. For example, between Charlotte and Raleigh is a state-owned corridor, very popular Piedmont rail service between those two cities in North Carolina. All right, rail in Charlotte. So I promised I would talk a bit about our own rail service. So here we are at our little train station, which is quickly being surrounded by giant developments. But it's this modest little station sitting right in the middle of West Main Street, as you know. And so Charlottesville, in its rail heyday, was actually a major east-west and north-south rail hub. Now, it is not that commonplace for a station to be sitting at the intersection of east-west and north-south tracks. And ours does. And Amtrak operates on both of them. But it's a very rare thing. And it's one of the reasons that our modest little train station is A, so successful, and B, you know, such a precious asset to the city, and one that we can't trifle with. Our rail activity in Charlottesville peaked in the 1920s. And believe it or not, there was a time up until 1956 when we had such frequent connections to Washington, D.C., between Charlottesville and Washington, that there were 22 trains a day going between the two of them, passenger trains. You could take a train any time, day or night, between Charlottesville and Washington. Southern Railway operated 16 daily trains to Washington and Charlotte, between Washington and Charlottesville, and the CNO Railroad operated 6 daily trains. And, you know, it was a way of life. I've talked to many old-timers who used to go up to Manassas on the train to see a ball game in the evening and come back the same evening. Or people used to go up and visit Grandma, you know, in Alexandria and have a picnic on Sunday and come back on the train. It was a very common thing. And so maybe some of us have been there and know what that's like. So. And, of course, then in 1971, Amtrak took over all the passenger service. And immediately overnight, we had only one daily round trip between Charlottesville and Washington on the Crescent, the Amtrak long-distance Crescent. And then the Cardinal would come in 3 days a week, both north and south, but only 3 days a week. So we were a perfect example of how routes and service was dramatically lost when Amtrak happened. So what do we have? We have, first of all, we have the Cardinal 3-day-a-week service. It connects Charlottesville with Chicago, Illinois, all the way up to New York City. It has stops in 32 cities along the way, and many of them in West Virginia have no other form of transportation, interstate transportation. It carries 102,000 passengers annually, and Charlottesville is second on the entire route. Charlottesville puts on so many passengers that it's second only to Chicago itself, where the train originates in terms of our ridership on that train. Furthermore, the connection, if you look at the city pairs, people going between Charlottesville and New York or Charlottesville and Washington and so forth, the connection between Charlottesville and New York is the number one ridden city pair on the Cardinal. And the connection between Charlottesville and Chicago is the third highest number of passengers on the Cardinal. And that's what we're doing here in Charlottesville. We are a train riding community. Then we have the Crescent, the Daily Crescent, which used to be the Southern Crescent. It runs from New Orleans up to New York through Charlottesville, and it carries 278,000 some odd passengers a year. It stops in 33 cities along the way, and of those 33 cities, Charlottesville puts more passengers on the Crescent than any other city on the route. 26,800 passengers, or 9.6% of the entire ridership on the Crescent, comes right here in little old Charlottesville. So, and our connection between Charlottesville, that's CBS, that's our Amtrak sort of moniker, and New York Penn Station is the number four city pair in terms of frequency of ridership, and number five city pair is Charlottesville to New York Penn Station. So, in 2005, we organized, as Rich mentioned, Seaville Rail, a group of local rail advocates who began working very hard across the state, lobbying for making the case for more rail service for Central Virginia. We only had one daily service. And we knew, just instinctively, we knew that this would be a strong rail riding community. I didn't have those numbers I just showed you at the time, but we knew that we were a strong rail riding community. And 2 years later, we formed the Piedmont Rail Coalition, where basically we went up and down the U.S. 29 corridor and enlisted every local government, 22 of them, chambers of commerce, universities, other businesses, all up and down the corridor, and we said, let's get together and make this happen. And we did. It was 4 years later after Seaville Rail was begun and 2 years after the coalition was begun that we got the Northeast Regional service. It was Virginia's first state-supported service. And this was before the federal law was passed that said states have to start paying for their regional services. Virginia did it first, and they did it ahead of the rest. And why did they do it? Because, or how could they do it? Because of the public policies that had gone before that allowed us to have access to the funds to do it. And so that's the ribbon cutting. Boy, I love that day. That was a grand and glorious day, and although it was a microcosm of what you saw in the video, we had a bunch of people out that day with balloons and flags cheering us on. We had a brass band. We had Thomas Jefferson himself there. So, and here is yours truly, and we're cutting the ribbon. This, as you recognize, David Toscano. Here's the president of Norfolk Southern WIC Mormon. A couple of folks from Lynchburg, one of our delegates who was very helpful, David Toscano and Shannon Valentine, were in the General Assembly at the time, and they were very helpful to us. And here is Governor Linwood Holton, who is a big train advocate, Governor Kane, and here is Representative Bell. And it was a wonderful, wonderful day. And took its first revenue run the next day. And so here are the numbers on that. Since it began in 2009, that train has carried 1,038,476 passengers as of the end of 2015. And last year, it carried, in 2015, 190,000 passengers on that train. Charlottesville is far and away the number one station on the route, including in the Northeast Corridor, the entire route up to Boston. Charlottesville puts 84,000 people a year on that train, and it is number one on the route in terms of ridership. The number one city pair is Charlottesville to Washington. The number two city pair is Charlottesville to New York City. So, sorry, folks, I know I brag about Charlottesville, but look what we're doing. I mean, look what we're doing. It's pretty wonderful. And we're ready for another one, aren't we? We're ready for our second frequency, and that is going to happen. So, Charlottesville had in all of its train service, not just the Northeast Regional, but last year we put 134,000 people on trains that got on and off trains in Charlottesville. At our little tiny station that has a waiting room that holds 75 people maximum, and no canopies overhead, no loading platforms, you know, no amenities at all. So we've come a long way since the station was renovated and we had 28,000 passengers in 1977. And we had the 134 passengers. It is almost all due to the Northeast Regional that began in 2009. And there are the numbers for the Northeast Regional. It was predicted it would have 51,000 passengers its first year. In fact, we had 126,000 passengers the first year that it ran. And last year it had almost 190,000. So, and that's just Lynchburg to Washington. Those numbers are only Lynchburg to Washington, right there. They're not, they don't include the numbers in the Northeast Corridor. So, we are fortunate enough to have had some advocates for rail on what you've all heard about and read about and are experiencing firsthand now, and that's the alternatives, US 29 bypass alternatives, package of alternatives that's taking place. In fact, the panel that was convened by the governor to decide on this package of alternatives was deeply divided, as you probably know, on the alternatives. And our neighbors to the south in Lynchburg and Danville were not happy to abandon the 29 bypass. But there was one thing that they did agree upon, but it had to be put into their minds. And my colleague that I work with at the Virginia Rail Policy Institute, Tripp Pollard, who's a lawyer with the Southern Environmental Law Center, was on that panel. And he introduced the idea of one alternative to all the congestion on US 29 has got to be a rail solution. And everybody said, we're talking about interchanges here. We're talking about road widening. The next meeting, he said, we've got to be talking about a rail solution. And people said, okay, we'll look into it. And by the next meeting, people were all starting to coalesce. Okay, maybe that is a good idea. We could get a second frequency of the Lynchburg train. And all of a sudden, Lynchburg is on board with that. Okay, so we begin to see a coincidence of interest. And finally, in the final package that they passed, there was a $5 million of the money that they had for the alternative set aside to start investing in equipment for a second frequency of the Lynchburg train. But the following week, when the Commonwealth Transportation Board approved the whole package, they added another $27 million for that train. And so what's sitting there now in the state DOT Treasury is $32 million waiting to start a second Northeast Regional out of Lynchburg. Now, why isn't it starting? Well, one of the reasons is because right now, our current Northeast Regional overnights in Lynchburg. Before it started, it overnighted in Washington. So now it just comes down to Lynchburg and overnights there and leaves in the morning. That's how Amtrak does its Northeast Regionals for Virginia. So there's a one train capacity in that facility for holding it overnight in Lynchburg at the station. And they maintain it, they clean it, you know. But they can't accommodate two until that train, which is slated in 2017, if indeed they make it by that time, is the first train is scheduled to go to Roanoke. So after that starts, that train, the first one, will be overnighting in Roanoke. Then we can bring a second train in to overnight in Lynchburg. So that's what the holdup is. But we do have that money set aside, although it's only about half of what the capital costs are going to be to start the second frequency. Okay? Why are these capital costs so high? Because, as I mentioned, the host railroads, the corporate railroads, the freight railroads that own the infrastructure want capacity improvements. If they're going to add your freight, your passenger train, they want you to invest in some capacity improvements on their tracks. And so it's the cost of doing business for passenger rail. And so we have to invest in improvements on their infrastructure, whether or not they're directly related to the passenger service or not. And that's why these cost as much as they do. All right, so now that I've mentioned the freight railroads often, I want to talk just a little bit. I want to catch you up on this. Now, this, I'm kind of new to this. I've been working at the Rail Policy Institute for a number of years with a good many people who have deep professional roots in the freight industry, and I've learned a lot about it, but I do not consider myself by any means to be an expert. But I work with people who were senior vice presidents at Norfolk Southern, who put together the Conrail deal, who were the CEO of RFMP Railroad. I mean, I work with a lot of railroad people. We even have one former Amtrak locomotive engineer on our board. So I have learned how these freight and passenger policy issues interact and why it's so important to us. So this is where your policy stuff begins to come in. Okay, freight rail in the United States. Freight rail has basically two main modes. It operates containers. It hauls things like coal and grains and stone and lumber and so forth on containers or on truck beds, flatbeds. Or it operates these big intermodal trains, which you often see, the double-stacked units that go by when you're waiting at the grade crossing. Well, that's intermodal service. And at some point in the history of those containers, they were on a boat. Probably they came in at Norfolk at the Virginia port. Then they got loaded onto trains. The train takes them across the country where they load onto trucks, and the trucks distribute them. And they're goods. They're filled with consumer goods. Okay, now that accounts for... I'm a little off track here. Let me move past that. It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. 33% of the cargo that comes into the Virginia Port Authority leaves or comes to the authority by rail. And the state, in fact, has invested a lot of that rail enhancement fund money in improving the rail connections to the ports. So intermodal freight is part of the business that the freight railroads take very seriously. So the consumer goods, which are by the containers and often on double stack trains, are only 9% of the freight rail business. Okay, across the country. You see a lot of them every time you stop. You know, a freight train goes by. You tend to see a lot of those double stacks, but they're actually only 9% of the business. 91% of it is the rail cars that carry the commodities, and that's bulk. And what railroads specialize in, and what they're so good at, are those commodities, because they can carry very heavy loads, very long distances, in a way that trucks can't compete with. Where they do compete with highway traffic is in the intermodal side, because trucks could be carrying those containers too. So, okay, I'm getting the move ahead signal, but coal has been the lifeblood of the freight industry for decades. 39% of rail tonnage in 2014 was made up of coal, and 19% of their revenue. And Norfolk, the Virginia port, is the leading U.S. port for coal exports. So our Virginia train services, our railroads, do a lot of hauling of coal. And 70% of all coal in this country is shipped by rail. But here's what's happened in the last couple years. This is the carloads of, this is just all carloads, no matter what was on them. This is all carloads. And you can begin to see in 2015 that was really starting to take a dip. And by this, the first 5 months of 2016, look at that huge, huge decline in carloads carried by the U.S. freight industry. And indeed, that little purple graph over on the left is the first 5 months of 2016. And it was already down the year before, and now it's down another 14%. And that's total carloads. But here's coal. And look where coal is, 30% down just in the first 5 months of 2015 from where it was, which was already down, 30, 40%. So coal, which is the lifeblood of the freight industry, is quickly shrinking, disappearing, frankly, as a market for freight, and it is not going to come back. So there is petroleum carloads. You know all the tank cars that carry the crude that we're so worried about coming through our communities? That's down another 20%. And that's partly because, American crude production is, I guess it's doing fine, but the prices are down. And so, let's see, is this revenue? No, it's not. It's carloads. I can't account for it. Anyway, and so this is carloads and intermodal. Both types of freight together are down 8%. Now, if you're a corporation, this is not good news. This is really bad news. One of the ways the train, freight railroads are responding is something they were starting to do anyway, and they're just doing more of, and that's two-mile-long trains. When was the last time you sat at a grade crossing? 2, 2.5 mile trains are now getting to be the norm for American railroads. And CSX and Norfolk Southern are the most, they're the ones trending towards that the most right here in Virginia. And there's a whole issue of Trains Magazine, which I subscribe to, of course, that's devoted to these huge, what they call, drag freight trains. And part of it has been enabled by the technology. There's new technology that's letting this occur now, and it's making it workable. It's more efficient. Guess what? You don't need the crews for it anymore. You don't need as frequent trains. You just wait until you've got enough load to carry it in a two-mile-long train. Fewer trains, less frequent, slower, heavier. So what happens to your Amtrak trains when they come into conflict? They wait long periods sometimes. And we're starting to notice long disruptions. Not so much on our corridor. And I can say that with a clear conscience. We're not experiencing. In fact, in April, our trains were 94% on time. But what's happening in the I-95 corridor, where the trains are coming in from the port and going to the port, and both intermodal and coal cars, and container cars, that is, and they're running 2, 2.5 miles long, 10 miles an hour. And many of the sidings that were built so that the freight train could go off to one side, theoretically, and let the passenger train pass, they're not long enough anymore. Much of the infrastructure is not suitable for that, which means there are breakdowns, there are all kinds of operational problems, and people are starting to notice on that corridor very long disruptions of service, of Amtrak service. So it is, it's another example of the sometimes troubled relationship between passenger and freight rail. So, and there are also some problems with lawsuits. The American Railroad Administration has filed a lawsuit in court to try to get Amtrak out of the business of helping to create regulatory, regulations, just the metrics for on-time performance. And because after all, what holds the passenger trains up is conflict with freight. And so, and of course the freight railroads do all the dispatching, and they're the ones who decide how long the trains are, how slow they're going, and so forth. And so if you're behind one of those trains, you are at their mercy. And the American Railroad Association has taken Amtrak to court and tried to keep them from being involved in any of the regulations trying to keep their trains on time. Also, and this is the last thing I'll talk about, believe it or not, there is some very, very serious potential revisions of the regulations at the federal level that would deeply affect the future of passenger rail in America. Two of them, both of them taking place at the Surface Transportation Board. You know how many people are on the Surface Transportation Board? Would you like to guess? Anybody know? Three people. Okay. And what they're doing is they're proposing a change in their regulatory rules. And one of them is they're changing the definition of the definition of on-time performance for Amtrak trains. All right. Now, if your train is over, if there's a pattern of late trains, Amtrak now has the right to file a complaint with the federal government and say, there's a history now where the railroad is not cooperating. Our host railroad is not cooperating. Our trains are not arriving on time. And the definition of on-time performance is something like 30 minutes, within plus or minus 30 minutes of scheduled arrival time. What they're trying to do now, or proposing to do, is change that definition so that it only applies to the end of the line, the last station on the line, whereas right now it applies to every station that you stop at. Well, something like 80% of Amtrak passengers don't go to the end of the line. And so if your on-time performance and what Amtrak has a right to by law in the way of on-time arrivals is only defined by the last station, they always build padding time into the schedule. So there's a half hour, an hour sometimes even built into that schedule. All they have to do is make sure that the train arrives at the end of the line on time. But it can be as late as as late as can be at every station along the route. And so that could be very difficult for Amtrak, as you can imagine, and they're fighting that. And at the Rail Policy Institute, where I'm president, we've had a lot to do with trying to correspond with the federal government about that, shall we say. And then finally, and this is the most important, when Amtrak was chartered in 1971, Congress passed a law that said the host railroads must give preference to the passenger trains. In a case where the two are in conflict, the passenger train's coming right up onto a freight train, the freight train is supposed to get out of the way. Now, it doesn't always happen, but it's supposed to happen at any rate, and they're proposing a change in that. And what they're proposing is to actually eliminate the preference rule for Amtrak. And that, I think, is probably one of the biggest policy issues that we're confronting today. So, again, the Rail Policy Institute has been deeply involved in position papers on this and that we've submitted to the federal government. And so, yes, we have all kinds of policy-related issues that have affected both the history of intercity passenger rail and could affect its future. And I'm going to leave the presentation. So thank you.
Thank Let me open it up for questions, and we're being podcast, which means you need to do it on a microphone. We have a microphone on each side, so just raise your hand and you'll be recognized.
Okay, I just wanted to say what fun I had riding a fast train in France.
Oh, yes.
Yes,
and I just wish we could do what the French do.
Yeah.
And I wish we could make all our railroads. I'm going to come back to him in a minute. I just was down here. If I was, when I sat on that train from Paris to Nice that my wife and I were on, we always went over there, and sometimes we went to Paris first to spend a couple of days and then took the train to Nice. It made a lot of sense. I'm sitting there, my first ride, and I see some cars up there out the window, and the next thing, the cars are right there. And the next thing, the cars are right there. That's the way they go. They 130 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah.
So now if we had that going down to Florida, and I would have to get off of 95 in my car, where I drove my wife down last January, and ride that train, and all the people who were on the highway would be happy that this 86-year-old guy was not driving there anymore. And so we get a lot of old people off the highway.
When you have procedures. Yes. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you for all the work you've done.
Thank
I'm
you.
So pleased.
I appreciate it.
Here, here. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
Question over there, and we've got one in the back.
Is this on? Okay.
Yes.
Just to follow up what he said, I lived in Europe for a while. And if you were going to catch the train at a certain time, if you weren't standing on the platform ready to get on the train, you would miss it because it just comes through and slows down. It comes to a full stop for about 30 seconds and then it goes on. And it's like riding on a cloud. I went up to Washington on the train in November and it was horrible.
Oh.
That track, I was afraid almost.
Really?
Because the track is so bad. It is so rough. And I probably would never have noticed it if I hadn't been in Europe and been on those trains, but we need to do something.
The Europeans never let their infrastructure deteriorate the way we have. They've always kept it up. And they don't. Their ratio of freight to passenger rail on that infrastructure is just the opposite of what it is in this
exactly.
country. And of course, they've always invested in passenger rail.
Thank you, Meredith. I'm Carol Chandros, and I belong to NARP, which you haven't talked about.
Yes.
I met some executives on the train one time, and they convinced me to join the organization. And I read about all the trains all across the country. And last year, I went to Florida, and I rode five cities watching the people struggling on the highway, and I was there in less than an hour and a half to 2 hours. And comfort and speed, and it didn't cost me more than $3 because I was a senior.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning NARP, the National Organization of Railroad Passengers. I commend you. If you're interested in rail, join NARP. It's really an excellent organization. We went to Washington. I've joined a couple of NARP people. The president and CEO of NARP was with me, and we went to visit Governor Kane's office just 3 weeks ago to talk about a few of the details about this FAST Act I mentioned, the Appropriations Act. And NARP was very helpful, and they are very interested in our rail station and have offered help. Not financial help, but all the advocacy help that they're capable of. And they are, in fact, involved now in helping us with the train station issue. So NARP's a great organization.
So thanks for all your good work. The Northeast Regional is great and so forth. But in the beginning, you showed us data on federal support for various kinds of transportation, and you said to tell your friends that everybody gets subsidized, and so don't. Let's be careful about that. But do you have a sense, if you want to peel that apart, I mean, what's the federal subsidy per unit traffic? for highways or passenger rail or freight rail?
Mm-hmm. Usually it's, you know, I don't have this data with me at the moment, but it's in terms of passenger miles traveled. That's a good way to, you know, to try to equalize. I don't have an answer for you on that, but I think it's a good question. I have some of the other data on that, things like fuel efficiency, emissions, and accidents, but I don't have it on the federal funding side. And that's the way, what he's saying is, how do you equate, you know, vehicles and highway spending with rail spending in terms of just the vehicle miles traveled or the passenger miles traveled. I don't have that information for you.
Do you have any sense of how our current political entries, how they support the changes that the railroads are trying to make?
At the federal level, the U.S. Department of Transportation has actually opposed the changes. They're taking place sort of independently of the USDOT, but the official word from the Secretary of Transportation of America is that he opposes these changes and the government opposes these changes. The Surface Transportation Board is a independent, you know, rulemaking board, and it should be, but they're sort of, and the only, I can tell you that hundreds of organizations like ours, the Virginia Rail Policy Institute, NARP, which she mentioned, Virginians for High Speed Rail, all over the country, rail groups have opposed that. And I think it would be, frankly, I think it would be surprising if it actually gets approved. But we'll just have to see. One of the things in the FAST Act that I mentioned early on that just passed is a rule to increase the membership of the Surface Transportation Board from 3 to 5 members. You know, so it's something. Other than that, in terms of, I can tell you, Governor McAuliffe, many of the governors who have rail service have written in about it, opposing it. So our two senators have opposed it in Virginia. I think it's entirely likely. The only statements I've seen that were submitted on behalf of the rule changes were by the freight railroads and the American Association of Railroads. So who knows how it's going to go? You don't know. You know, you just don't know.
Meredith, thank you very much. As a world traveler, I hate to bring this up, but when you're talking about the governments of different countries, this country is like made up of 50 countries. And each of those 50 countries, if they put money into it, it would be working. And that's how they do it in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Thank you, Meredith. I was on that first train.
Yay!
And I go back and forth to New York 3 or 4 times a year. It doesn't scare me. But I will say the Northeast Regional is a whole lot cleaner than the Crescent.
Oh, yes.
Because it's been going all night from New Orleans. Yeah. Thank you so much. Continue to take this one and any other train that comes along.
Thank you. We're working on it. It's true. It's and the Cardinal comes in pretty dirty, too.
Meredith, mm-hmm. You indicated at the outset that private ownership of tracks and bridges and other facilities are impediments?
Well, they're constraints.
Constraints. To what extent is eminent domain available to deal with that?
You know, it is available. Most rail corridors are interstate corridors. You know, they cross lots of jurisdictions. They cross lots of jurisdictional boundaries. And so eminent domain could conceivably be applied to part of a corridor by one political jurisdiction, but for a whole corridor, it would take multiple states probably, and who knows what else. It's been used more often. It has been used, but it's more often used for station facilities. And Kansas City, for example, recently used eminent domain to purchase. And I want to say it's not a taking; it's a purchase, but it's a fair market value purchase. It's a forced purchase, but it's at a fair market value. And they did use it to acquire a station that the price was unreasonable, and the owner, the private owner, was being resistant to selling. So I think if you're asking about public ownership, that is a question. That's an important policy question. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do at the Rail Policy Institute is investigate other models of the public-private relationship that might work on everybody's behalf a little bit more effectively than this model is working on. And I'm not going to try to evaluate those models at the moment because we're undertaking a year-long effort to try to develop forums and panels and consult some experts and write a series of white papers on alternative ways that the public-private partnership between the freight and rails and public transportation might work. And of course, one of them is public ownership of the infrastructure, which I think is what you're really getting at. And that's entirely possible, and it does happen. More often than not, public ownership where it exists because the railroads had already abandoned or were ready to sell track that they were no longer using. I don't think it's been tested that I'm aware of to use eminent domain for track or a bridge. I don't think that's been tested. I could be wrong. So we'll see what evolves. But I think it's a point in time now for us to be thinking about alternative models because I think what I tried to point out at the beginning of this talk is that Americans are ready for more passenger rail, and it could grow at a much faster rate than it's growing. We could have high-speed rail. For example, CSX. CSX owns a portion of the track between Newport News and Washington, and they have a rule, absolute rule. No train can travel more than 90 miles an hour on our track, period. And so if you're going to have high-speed rail, that Southeast High-Speed Rail Coalition we were talking about coming up from Raleigh and eventually coming up from Florida, you know, the segment between Richmond and Washington, of Petersburg and Richmond and so forth, segments owned by CSX are critical to that. But CSX has a fixed rule, 90 miles an hour, and that's it. And they've published that, and they've made it very clear. I'm not speaking anything proprietary here. So it is a constraint. And different models might be in order at this point in time. And with the railroads struggling, and one of the other things I didn't even mention is that they are starting to pull back on their own infrastructure. They're retiring parts of their infrastructure. Norfolk Southern has announced that they're putting 1,000 miles out of service.
So
you know, in their business, in their plan for the future. And it's because they can now run longer trains on the routes that support that, fewer trains, and still haul a lot of stuff. It also makes them not very competitive with truck, commercial truck traffic. You know, they're not out there competing for that business. And one of the things I mentioned to you was that as a public policy, one of the reasons the public invests in infrastructure is theoretically the goal is to take vehicles off the highways. But to do that, the freight railroads have to compete for that. You know, they have to be able to be competitive with trucks, and they're not doing that. So there are a lot of reasons why it's time to reexamine that whole relationship. I've heard people say that for years, but we've never seen the freight business dropping quite like this. We've never seen it pulling back and retrenching the way it is in a long time. So it's, you know, I understand your question. I think it's a good, very good question, and we ought to be looking into more public, different kinds of relationships between the public and the private here.
Well, that's a wonderful answer to great questions and all the answers, and it's a wonderful way of ending. I want to thank Meredith Richards for speaking to us today. If you'll give her a big round. Thank you very much for coming to the Senior Statesman of Virginia. We take July off. Our next session will be in August, and it will be the Congressional Forum. So right now we have the two major candidates coming to speak. We've invited the Independent and Libertarian as well. But that will be in August, and so we'll see you all in August. And again, thank you.